And we need more immigrants.
With immigration, we need immigrants. We need immigration.
This whole country owes our lifeblood and wealth to the hard work of immigrants.
Immigrants had been an integral part of Canada's development since its beginning.
Immigration remains an incredible strength and force for Canada.
This familiar slogan originates not from any founding document or constitution, but Hugh Keenly's side, a deputy minister in the Mackenzie King administration who oversaw immigration. Dr. Keenly's side was speaking in 1948 to a crowd who would have received this phrase as preposterous. In our current era, however, it is taken for granted. The story of Canadian identity as we understand it today has been subject to intense revisionist history described by George Grant as a nation that is always becoming, always changing. Despite our modern proclamations, Canadian public sentiment towards immigration was historically conservative, and there exist decades of opinion polls and data to verify this. Studies show that most Canadians during the period this famous quotation was coined did not, contrary to modern opinion, identify as immigrants, nor did they feel ideologically bound to accept newcomers. This is reflected in Prime Minister Mackenzie King taking a public hardline stance against immigration, especially from the region known at the time as the Orient. So, what changed? It becomes clear as we parse through the readily available polls and surveys that while popular opinion was always against increased immigration, there were forces at work within several administrations to secretly propel policies that furthered mass migration unbeknownst to the Canadian people until it was too late. We will see precisely how the Canadian public were always clear on their desires to restrict immigration and refugee claims. Most importantly, we will explore how mechanisms of the Canadian state operating contrary to these demands represent a definitive decline in the effectiveness of populism. The focus of this short film will be from the years immediately after World War II up into 1976, the year in which a new Immigration Act eliminated all vestiges of racial discrimination in immigration policy. This is the state in which we find ourselves today. In most cases, Canadians were roundly opposed to specifically non-white influxes, including the public refrain of populate or perish insofar as it related to immigration. In February of 1947, the Prime Minister's Cabinet commissioned a report on a general immigration policy with the purpose of avoiding discrimination on racial grounds and was produced by the Interdepartmental Committee on Immigration. May 1st of that same year saw Prime Minister King deliver a speech wherein he declared that there was no fundamental right for anyone to immigrate to Canada, specifically addressing the special problem of refugees presented by the wake of World War II.
In recent years, many thousands of people have come to Canada to take up new opportunities. They have left friends and relatives and familiar surroundings in search of contentment. And maybe to make a name for themselves, as so many other new Canadians have done before them.
At the beginning of the 20th century, when we began receiving large numbers of others, who were usually sort of designated as newcomers, or they were designated as hyphenated Canadians, the assumption was that they had to be assimilated, that they had to learn Canadian values, that they had to come to understand our political system, our social system, that perhaps if they had exotic cultural practices, these should be given up. And a fierce debate, for example, in the early years of the 20th century about whether Chinese and Japanese should be allowed into Canada, black people from the United States, all of these issues. This changed, I think, after World War II.
Why?
Because World War II struck a dagger into the notion that that humanity was fundamentally divided racially. Now, it didn't come easily or quickly after World War II. You know, it took about a quarter of a century, I think, for old attitudes in Canada to begin to break down.
The wave of migration inspiring this public backlash was pushed primarily by the new United Nations. King's response gave the impression that this issue would be dealt with in the future, incrementally and with caution. Only days later, his administration launched what is widely regarded as the largest refugee initiative in Canadian history up until that point.
Mr. Speaker, before the House resumes the debate on the second reading of the bill to amend the Immigration Act, I should like to set forth, in broad outline, the government's policy with respect to immigration. The policy of the government is to foster the growth of the population of Canada by the encouragement of immigration. The government will seek by legislation, regulation, and vigorous administration to ensure the careful selection and permanent settlement of such numbers of immigrants as can advantageously be absorbed into our national economy. Like other major problems of today, the problem of immigration must be viewed in the light of the world situation as a whole. A wise and productive policy for Canada cannot be devised by studying only the situation within our own country. For example, temporary but effective limits on any policy that is to be applied immediately are created by the problem of providing ocean transportation and of establishing inspection facilities in certain countries to which access is difficult at present. Moreover, Canada's policy has to be related to the social, political, and economic.
King publicly maintained his anti-immigration stance while his administration was secretly implementing the opposite. This separation between public officials addressing their constituents and the true goals of the state apparatus would become an oft-ignored trend over the preceding decades. This is not to say Mackenzie King was lying about his personal views, but he was certainly not upfront with the external pressure Canada was experiencing. As an example, the post-war Displaced Persons Program was launched against King's approval, even though those brought into Canada from 1946 to 1951 were mostly of European extraction. The backsliding of the Prime Minister on this issue would very soon be pivoted through force for the benefit of non-Europeans, as King himself warned.
There is going to be a great danger of the UN refusing the idea of justifiable rights of selected immigration with racial and other discriminations.
The collective force of the United Nations, which King could not repel, only brought to fruition an argument advocated by the Liberal backbench MP David Kroll in 1945. Kroll, born in Russia and holding the title as the first Jewish cabinet minister, criticized existing policy by quipping,
"We have on our statute books at the present time a great deal of racial nonsense."
Kroll suggested that Canada had a duty to live up to its obligations and responsibilities, and that the Canadian government should purposefully turn towards countries other than those from which it had traditionally sourced immigrants, meaning outside of Europe. These arguments found the most support from the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation MPs, the predecessor to the NDP, whose ridings had a multitude of immigrants finding this adhering to their own self-interests. The growth of both the economy and the population in the years following the Second World War was a phenomenon that hit the entire Western world. According to Mildred Schwartz in her book Public Opinion and Canadian Identity, 1945 saw the largest support for population expansion at 65% approval. Schwartz, and likely many viewers currently, presumed that those in favor had immigration as the primary driver of growth, rather than increased fertility. This is crucial since, according to data gathered by Dr. Duchesne, Canada's population boom between 1941 and 1962 was mostly a result of local natality.
Actually, if you look at many textbooks, they openly put whites in a bad light. They talk always about the bad things they did, the head tax here, the way natives were treated here when we first arrived, the internment of the Japanese.
In July of 1947, the government acknowledged that support for an inflow of carefully selected immigrants had increased over the preceding year, a sentiment which reportedly existed as far back as 1944. The phrasing of carefully selected was due to a Gallup poll that showed two-thirds of Canadians opposed European migration. That said, after broad-scale immigration was undertaken during this period, public support for even this selective policy dropped drastically, with a disapproval rate of 67% by 1960. Though population expansion was justified in the sparsely populated West for reasons related to economic and national security, a loose survey of recent Canadian history reveals how population increase can come from within. For example, from 1815 to 1851, the population of Lower Canada blossomed from 330,000 to 890,000 without immigration as the driver. Quebec's population similarly reached almost 4 million by 1950, and the baby boom from 1941 to 1962 brought Canada's total population from 11.5 million to 18.5 million. The national narrative is that population growth can only come from a steady flow of newcomers, whereas the most profound influencer of growth in the previous century was due to naturally rising birth rates. Astoundingly, the Canadian state currently lacks interest in natural birth rates, even in Aboriginal communities. There is no narrative that exists in academia or popular culture that pins population growth to the health and vitality of a group, even for groups that are routinely pushed as essential to Canadian identity, a benefit no longer afforded to Euro-Canadians. This is relevant because while migration is often understood to be unfiltered and global, the goal of a European Canada was historically espoused by every prime minister from Confederation up to and including Louis Saint Laurent.
If you look around the world, you will see that the Aryan races will not wholesomely amalgamate with the Africans or the Asiatics. It is not to be desired that they should come, that we should have a mongrel race, that the Aryan character of the future of British America should be destroyed by a cross or crosses of that kind. The world is filling up fast enough. We can be in no very great hurry to have our 100 millions in British America. That will come fast enough. Let us encourage all the races which are cognato races, which cross and amalgamate naturally, and we shall see that such an amalgamation will produce, as the result, a race equal, if not superior, to the two races which mingle.
Furthermore, the cycling in of new blood, new ideas, and new identities into Aboriginal tribal bands would be considered genocidal by both the legal framework of these communities and the federal government. The pressure that Mackenzie King experienced would prove even more taxing on his successor, Saint Laurent, especially after the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights passed in December of 1948.
This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere. We hope its proclamation by the General Assembly will be an event comparable to the proclamation of the Declaration of the Rights of Man by the French people in 1789, the adoption of the Bill of Rights by the people of the United States, and the adoption of comparable declarations at different times in other countries.
Demands were made by the new international community for Canada to accept more refugees and migrants. To appease the emerging status quo, the King and Saint Laurent governments chose to avoid potential backlash by hiding their immigration projects from public and press scrutiny. Specific policies were circulated internally to bureaucrats without official announcement. Of course, some major developments could not be hidden, such as the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act during the King administration, despite his reservations against Asiatic migration, and was another result of UN influence. Conservative Party MP Davy Fulton expressed his faction's solidarity with Liberal King in his opposition to both UN obligations. Bipartisan consensus within Canada, however, could not stop international forces.
Through some other interpretation of the United Nations Charter, of our being called upon to accept large numbers of immigrants from any country. I am certainly glad to have the statement from the Prime Minister that no such attitude will be adopted.
By the 1950s, public opinion on migration remained, at best, divided, and as a result, the government studiously avoided publicizing its activities. In fact, following the passing of the 1952 Immigration Act, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, Walter Harris, said of public sentiment that Canadians generally agreed with his government's immigration policy. However, based on polling data, Canadians were decidedly unsupportive, which is especially illuminating considering the public had not been informed of any changes occurring. How could they agree with policies they had not been told about? The two immigration objectives of the Saint Laurent years were as follows. Firstly, achieving yearly immigration numbers through a defined program while avoiding public scrutiny. Secondly, spinning the nature of immigration on the occasion it was actually disclosed to Canadians as purely economic and far away from anything political. This was evidenced in 1954 by Minister Pickersgill, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration at the time, admitting that immigration policy since 1947 had a primary
purpose that was social rather than economic.
The Saint Laurent administration used several tricks to stifle criticism of its policies in Parliament, including pushing back debates on immigration targets. Though the Conservative Party complained of their approach, Minister Walter Harris rightly assumed that the objections were all talk, as the opposition had no substantive quarrel with the basic tenets of the Liberal government's immigration policy. It was a bold call-out, one that would reveal the working relationship of both parties in the succeeding years. Minister Pickersgill gave a radio interview affirming that the Canadian government was not going to permit any mass immigration from Asia and the British West Indies. In spite of this declaration, he rolled back black immigration restrictions the following year, allowing workers from the Caribbean to arrive in Canada as domestic workers. The Negro Citizens Coalition leader Donald Moore opined that this was the first time that Negro migration of any kind in Canada had been planned. This was a point of pride for Pickersgill, who described the motion fondly in his memoirs, describing the program as allowing increased Caribbean immigration in future years, and was an example of a series of significant changes the Saint Laurent regime put into place. His delight in the effectiveness of his subterfuge was clear. Pickersgill's actions were even contrary to the opinion of other officials, such as Immigration Branch Director C.E.S. Smith, who wrote in January 1955 that the Canadian public, apart from certain minority groups, is not willing to accept any significant group of Negro immigrants. Their opinions were identical, the reality of the public's position being so apparent. Furthermore, Minister Pickersgill was more than aware of public sentiment at the time, closely monitoring his correspondence to gauge the citizenry's opinion, even stating during an April 1955 cabinet meeting that the majority of the population was against immigration most of the time. Additionally, a March 1956 memo sent to the minister noted that Canadians were split on the matter of immigration and that they showed greater unanimity when given a chance to vote on discriminatory immigration. Pickersgill acted against political and public opinion, doing all he could to make incremental adjustments to the rules and to the nation's fundamental character. Here we see the justification for radical action permitted through the deployment of specific terminology. While the immigration was shocking and discombobulating, Pickersgill could in good faith deny it was mass immigration. As long as the changes are made with incremental shifts with the selective interpretation of clauses and national spirit, anything is possible. While bringing in East German refugees to fill farm quotas in May of 1956, he temporarily dispensed with normal security screening procedures entirely. The minister waved off his colleagues' hesitation by saying no publicity would be given to such actions, of course, and the risk of getting planted communist agents in this short period seemed rather small. Just 10 years earlier, the Gusenko affair had ignited awareness of communist infiltration and the Soviet spy networks in Canada.
Most of the agents whom you exposed in 1945 were Canadians in the employ of the Soviet Union.
Yes, most of them.
Were there names on your list that were not published by the Royal Commission that investigated your charges?
No, all names which have real names were published, and which have cover names and real names, they were published. But there were some names, cover names, without real names. Mm-hmm. Now, this one still remain cover names without real names. In other words, they were not discovered.
Yes.
When one examines the overtly unpopular policy prescriptions undertaken by Harris and then Pickersgill, the only explanation for such actions is ideological motivation. Both Harris and Pickersgill understood that negative public opinion regarding foreigners, or the other, could be overcome, and so the process of transforming the race-based components of immigration began during their tenures. These two individuals were the prime movers of what would become the attitude of the average Canadian towards immigration, certain as they are that it has always been this way, rather than shadowy politicking beginning in the late 1940s.
And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed.
The reign of the Conservative Party from 1957 to 1963 was a confused one, which ultimately did not produce a new Immigration Act to rebalance the moves perpetrated by the preceding Liberal Party. They were, however, responsible for an order of in council in 1962 that eliminated almost all racial discrimination from immigration criteria. Prior to its passing by the nominal Conservatives, very few non-Europeans were admitted into Canada. The notion of a politician's personal beliefs divorced from policy would dissipate during the tenure of Prime Minister Diefenbaker, a man whose anti-racism was central to his identity. Diefenbaker's first speech of his federal campaign promised a vigorous immigration policy, though the press did not cite immigration as a campaign issue to take note of after he won.
How do you feel about the role of the Commonwealth in the world of today? Do you feel its influence may be lessening?
It's an undefinable thing. We're far apart, geography, in race, in religion. But we're spread all over the world. We have the Western representatives. We have Eastern representatives. I don't know what the reason for it is. When one visits a Commonwealth country, whatever the color, whatever the race, there's an affinity. There's a feeling of brotherhood.
John Diefenbaker was a fascinating linchpin because, of course, he himself, although born in the country, was of German-Canadian descent, and he felt very strongly that he was a spokesman for ethnic Canadians, or people who had been seen as hyphenated Canadians. Diefenbaker wanted to erase that hyphenization, and he wanted, in a sense, to recognize people of every ethnicity as equally Canadian.
Diefenbaker's story is again emblematic of how this secret bureaucratic process occurs. For example, he told his cabinet that colored immigration could be resisted if it were on the grounds of adaptability to Canada's way of life rather than overt racism. When in 1957 Acting Minister of Public Works Davy Fulton recommended a yearly immigration target of 150,000, the cabinet assented only after being told the number would not be released to the public. While all of this was occurring, the public sentiments were clearer than ever. The numbers were widely understood, with a coherence seemingly foreign to modern political discourse. It could be argued that the Diefenbaker administration's conflicted immigration regulations mirrored not just negotiation with public sentiment, but something deeper in the Prime Minister's psyche. He had once revered Canada's British founding and the Commonwealth, but was also vehemently anti-racist to his core. His battle against discrimination likely originated with the anti-German sentiment experienced in his formative years, as explored in Dennis Smith's biography, Rogue Tory. Even the idea of a checkbox to identify one's ethnic origins on the Canadian census offended Diefenbaker's sensibilities. He would have liked to do away with it entirely. In his ideal Canada, there would be no distinctions of race or national origin, no hybrid collection of minorities, visible or invisible, but instead a united nationality of equals. This attitude of Diefenbaker's culminated in the 1960 Bill of Rights, which is something he had advocated for in Parliament since at least the 1940s in the aftermath of the Gazenko affair.
You asked me the question, what would a Bill of Rights do for you? A national Bill of Rights would safeguard our freedoms of religion, speech, press, radio, and association. It would declare the equality of all Canadians and would take a forthright stand against discrimination based on color, creed, or racial origin. It would deny that there are first and second class citizens in our country measured by color, race, or surname.
Two of the major proponents of the Bill of Rights were Jewish conservative advisor Eddie Goodman and then-lawyer Bora Laskin, who would become the first Jewish Supreme Court justice under Trudeau Sr. Interestingly, Laskin publicly criticized the Bill of Rights, saying it did not go far enough.
It would be better that no bill be proposed so that the common law tradition be maintained through the unifying force and position of the Supreme Court of Canada. And better, too, in such case, to allow that court to continue unaided in developing constitutional doctrine. The proposed bill deals only obliquely with what I have classed as the egalitarian view of liberty.
What occurred was a direct attack on what was known unofficially as the White Canada Policy, the abandonment of which in 1962 was inspired by officials as the public had not protested or otherwise denounced such a blueprint. Minister Ellen Fairclough and her deputy, George Davidson, believed themselves hard-pressed to pass a new immigration act. They settled instead for the anti-racist Order in Council.
I might say this. I have been the minister of this department now for something less than 4 years, and I have been engaged in the study of a revision of this act for something approaching 2 years. I have received representations from various groups. Those representations were not that this government should hurry and bring in a new act, but quite the reverse. The representations from these groups were, "Go slowly. Do not be too quick in this matter. Give us a chance to talk to you about it." That we have done. I should have liked to bring in a new act complete with regulations at one time, but it became evident very soon in our study of the act that this was probably not a wise course. Therefore, we took the alternative, and we have brought in regulations, which I submit to this House are workable, flexible, and will permit the entry of many persons who were heretofore denied entry to Canada. I think it was in 1959. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that I will not be quoted on this as a statement of fact, because I am depending on my memory. That we admitted some 7,000 persons to this country by order in council because they did not qualify for entry under the old act or the old regulations. This is a rather ridiculous situation when there are so many persons who are welcome to Canada by reason of their peculiar circumstances or qualifications, but who are prohibited from entry because of the legislation which is in effect. We believe that with the new regulations, we have cured that situation.
Minister Fairclough and Deputy Davidson were not influenced by popular demand or imposition of Parliament. Rather, they saw existing legislation as impossible to reconcile with membership in the United Nations or the existence of what was known then as the multiracial Commonwealth. Their goal was to gain access to the international community, a dream for many Canadian bureaucrats.
The conference would have been impossible if countries were to believe that the world community tried to impose on them directives on this matter. A systematic presentation of what are the options open to certain countries if they want to follow certain policies.
Once again, we can see this was a bipartisan strategy. In the spring of 1963, enthusiastic commentator David Corbett wrote in the International Journal,
"The Conservatives' immigration policy has probably been in advance of public opinion in several respects. Reform through change of regulation gives less opportunity to die-hard opponents of cosmopolitan immigration than would a full-scale national debate and a new act of parliament. Recent trends therefore support the inference that the government means to administer the new immigration regulations in such a way as to bring more Africans, Asians, and other non-whites into Canada as immigrants each year."
The implication is that it is merely forward-thinking with a populace slow to evolve and critics unnecessary to the divine mission. Lester Pearson's administration did not see much change to immigration in his way of policy. His order of counsel on immigration did close some racial loopholes, primarily concerned with family admittance for non-white immigrants. It is accepted by many modern Canadians as elementary, but there was a time when it did not rationally follow that a newly landed immigrant should expect to bring in both their immediate and sometimes extended family. This change only occurred in 1967. The governments of the 1970s and 1980s had a different approach to policymaking, with transparency promoted as the new normal. Regular reassurance from leading politicians as to the benefits of artificial population expansion was deemed essential to satisfy public concern. By this point, the Canadian public had already been primed to accept that the phenomena of immigration somehow occurred irrespective of the designs of those in power. Politicians began to be seen as well-meaning but ultimately powerless before this trend. The early 1970s under Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau saw a series of changes to Canada's immigration scheme announced by its multiculturalism policy in the tail end of 1971. Robert Andrus took his position as Minister of Manpower and Immigration the following year, and by 1973 he was paving the way to the 1976 Immigration Act with the help of Deputy Alan Gottlieb. Andrus and Gottlieb oversaw the 1973 Adjustment of Status program, which dealt with a crisis of illegal immigration by granting landed immigrant status to 52,000 aliens, a move supported by the national media and all major political parties.
There was an immigrant run on Canada in near record numbers, the second highest in history. And the prospect was that without new regulations, Canada would, within a few years, be unable to cope, to provide jobs, housing, and care to all the newcomers. There were undertones of racial reaction, but the immigration minister, Robert Andrus, said it was mainly a concern for the sheer numbers that led him to announce in October plans to cut back on our open-door policy.
We will, even this year, 1974, have in excess of 200,000 landed immigrants arrive. It is our opinion that had we not taken these measures today, the immigration volume of landings for 1975 could reach between 250,000 and 260,000, and we look beyond 1975 to an even much higher rate of numbers than that. So it is the numbers that are bothering us at the moment. In the face of a year or two of pressures upon our ability to employ our own Canadians and permanent residents in this country.
Andrus chose to close the program later in October, but conservatives astoundingly clamored for an extension so more illegal immigrants could be regularized. Against the wishes of conservatives, the extension was not granted. Once more, the precedent was set and the floodgates began to open. The path to the 1976 Immigration Act began with the submission of the Green Paper on Immigration Policy, received by the Cabinet in the fall of 1974. The first of four volumes were surprisingly candid, having what was described as a pessimistic tone. Volume 1 linked Canada's multiracial immigration movement to the problems of urban congestion and incipient social tensions in urban areas. The media and pro-immigration advocates were displeased with these inferences. Thank you. In March of 1975, a special joint committee of the Senate and House was created to field public hearings on the Green Paper. This committee was tasked with collecting input and then drafting its own recommendations for parliamentary action based on this interfacing with the public. These hearings, as one might expect, were not in the town halls originally proposed. As a result, the general public was poorly represented at these events. Proxies of Canada's Communist Party and other pro-immigration groups often hijacked these public hearings, their disruptive tactics helping activists bully their way through meetings with the end goal of disbanding them entirely. The committee heard mostly from national organizations, special interest groups, and individuals already involved with the immigration initiatives. Martin O'Connell, co-chairman of the joint committee, admitted that his group had not reached the general public. It is doubtful that committee members had any intention of listening to the public in the first place. They reportedly turned their backs firmly on what they categorized as racist mail, or those presentations that contained what they deemed to be irrational anti-immigration beliefs. Considering the public, as polling showed, was not happy or at the very least skeptical of migrant expansionism, one could easily imagine any detraction of such a policy would be characterized as irrational and discarded. The Green Paper hearings only lasted 6 months. This was intentional, so writer and political scientist Freda Hawkins admits in her landmark work, Canada in Immigration.
It did not reach the average Canadian for one simple reason, because the minister and cabinet did not trust the average Canadian to respond in a positive way on this issue and thought this would create more trouble than it was worth. As a result of this view, they did not want to commit the funds to organized extensive public participation and made only a minimal effort to mobilize the media on behalf of a truly national debate.
Another issue tackled by the Andrus Gottlieb team prior to the new Immigration Act was the perceived need for an official population policy. Prior to attending the 1974 UN Population Conference, Canadian officials were already planning an immigration and population review. The stifling of debate along with secret population targets run counter to the mainstream narrative that the Canadian government was transparent during this period. While official policies are often disclosed to the public, its goals or targets are decided upon beforehand. The Special Joint Committee put forth 65 recommendations following the Green Paper hearings, with 60 of them ultimately accepted by Parliament. This piece of legislation replaced the previous Act of 1952 and built upon the message of anti-racism set forth by the regulations of 1962 and 1967. A clear evolution of narrative appears over the course of these decades, each step dependent on the minor and incremental shifts of the last. The final report of the hearings was received well by the government and pro-immigration groups. The press, however, failed to comment on the report, so the Canadian public heard little of it. Why was the result of something intended for popular input left unannounced? In her time, Hawkins publicly singled out the Jewish community, saying it had exercised pressure in its own areas of concern in immigration in a very individual and successful way. This was orchestrated by making direct approaches to senior officials in the department and, on important issues, to the minister or other members of the cabinet. During the mid-20th century, Canadian politicians increasingly defined our nation based on the identities of outsiders, in stark contrast to the wills and memories of those living who experienced it. It was this period where an eventual replacing of old-stock citizens with third-world immigrants was engineered, something Canadians were generally unaware of and had expressed strong disapproval of whenever consulted, in the myriad of variations the question was put forward. Systemic apathy held by most politicians was taken advantage of by ideologically possessed lawmakers, whom some may presume were, in their own minds, acting in the people's best interest. Even if this were true, they did constituents a disservice by failing to inform them of the challenges which required an overhaul of immigration management entirely. When they had the opportunity to actively seek outside assessment, it was special interest and/or ethnic advocacy groups. The populace was increasingly deemed unnecessary to the goals and agendas of the Canadian government and the radical groups it conspired with. This brings us to our current historical period. Up until the 1960s, Canada had an explicitly exclusionary immigration policy on paper, yet the groundwork for ethnic replacement was laid in the post-war era in spirit, executed by only a handful of individuals. The King government yielded to international pressure from the UN and turned to softer language when trying to keep out groups such as the Chinese. Later, activist bureaucrats in the Saint Laurent era poked holes in what they deemed racist decision-making, allowing select groups of non-whites to enter Canada. It took a true anti-racist in the form of Diefenbaker to allow the elimination of racial restrictions despite being labeled a nationalist. We can see in this period what happens when the word nationalist is separated from the word white, and what powers are granted to the state bureaucracy once identity is not made explicit. Later still, Pierre Trudeau, with his Immigration Act, oversaw the final turn towards mass influxes of third worlders and refugee claims into Canada. With the proliferation of immigrants and a new stock of Canadians, the opinion polls, which clearly indicated that the majority did not desire this change, have obviously tilted towards broad acceptance, which was always the intended consequence. Those who believed this transition was inevitable understood that it was only a matter of time until their true machinations could be unveiled in victory. While the negative cultural, social, political, and financial impacts of mass migration are resoundingly noted in the early years of the 2020s, politicians simply hand-wave concerns with assertions that our predecessors voted themselves into the situation. This is what our ancestors wanted, we are told. Upon closer investigation, this is revealed to be an abject falsehood, and the myth of Canada's colossal welcome sign is a total retcon of recent history. Many Canadians, patriotic to their core and possessing a vivid recollection of their own history, can likely call back to a time when immigration restriction was taken for granted as common sense. Many baby boomers can point to powerful and relatively recent demarcations in the nation's identity. However, once that generation passes into history, we will have radically fewer stock from which to pull these narratives from, however true they may be. Time is now of the essence to engage, enhance, and empower what connections we can with this fading demographic before mythology supplants history entirely.